Radio Free Palmer, 89.5 KVRF, presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, and you're listening to Mush You Huskies and Mushing Radio on KVRF FM in 89.5 in Palmer, Alaska. And on the line today, we have a good friend of mine, hails from the Northern California area. Her name is April Cox. April, how's it going?
Hi, Robert. It's going pretty good.
You know, I haven't spoke to you in a couple of years now, but I'm glad you're back on the radio. I know you were on when you were still living down sort of Central California area, but you've moved and changed things up a little bit, haven't you?
Yes, I certainly have. I've moved. I used to live down near Fresno, and now I live up in the far northeast corner of California in a little town called Aden.
And you moved up there solely for dog sledding? Are you one of those that packed up the truck and pretty much left everything behind in sake of the dogs?
Well, no, I didn't necessarily leave everything behind. I brought my dogs and my horses and my son up with me. And I did leave the husband behind. I'm now divorced. So it's just me and free and single. And
Congratulations on your new place. And, you know, I'm sure all of your people that are listening today, especially all of your Facebook friends, know all about your kennel. But for folks that don't know anything about you, go ahead and introduce yourself. Who are you and what are you all about?
Okay, my name is April Cox. I've had Siberian Huskies since 1985. I've been actively dog sledding and racing since 2004 when I entered my first race, or maybe it was 2005. I forget sometimes. But I've had Siberian Huskies. I do AKC dog shows, but I've done more racing and sledding in the last 8 years. And I have a kennel of about 30-something Siberians. I try not to count.
That's a handful, isn't it?
Well, it's not too bad. It's pretty good. I can manage. It's manageable for me.
You know, the first question I have, April, is the obvious question that a lot of folks are going to ask is, how can a musher live in California? I'm sure a lot of people think, when they think of California, they think of L.A. and San Francisco and San Diego and that sort of stuff. So go ahead and describe where you live and how that is in relation to climate and that sort of thing.
Okay, sure. Yeah, I live up in the mountains at elevation of just under 5,000 feet, and we even had snow. I even had snow in my front yard in the first part of June this last summer. The climate here is much different than anyone would expect of anywhere in California. I've been to most parts of California, and the climate here is just so different. The air is pretty clear and cool, and we get some really nice temperatures, and I've already started training my dogs up here, and it's pretty amazing.
So you mentioned 5,000 feet. Are you there in the lower Cascades there, or is that still the Sierra Nevada range in California?
It's the eastern Sierras, almost to the north end.
And how far are you from Oregon?
Well, from the border, it's a 100-mile drive to Klamath Falls, which is just north of the border, and it takes me, so you have to kind of go around the, but straight as the crow flies, it's probably a little less than that.
So you're very far removed from the City of Angels down there in Los Angeles then?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it takes 8 hours just to drive to Fresno, let alone another 5 or 6 to get to the City of Angels.
So you mentioned that you're a Siberian musher, Siberian breeder, show quality dogs. I know your dogs very well. I have 3 of them of my own. I have Carter, Bodie, and Reagan, and both of those older guys and gals are on my A team right now and doing very well. I even have Bodie running in lead for me this year. So I want to commend you on your awesome dogs. You guys breed some heck of a good racing Siberians down that way.
Well, thank you, Robert. Yes, I have 5 of Reagan's siblings, and they were all on my A-team last winter, and although I only made it to two races, we did a heck of a lot of training. We clocked over 900 miles training runs, and every single one of them made it the entire season. Well, Mahindra, the other female, only made it through till February because she got pregnant, and so she had to get dropped off. But she made it up to about 800 miles, and I stopped running her when she was about 4 weeks pregnant. But the rest of them are just super, super. They've all run up in lead, and I just that line's just amazed me. I've come a long way.
You know, April, we have a lot of folks that follow Iditarod that listen to this show. And a month or so ago, we had on another Siberian Husky musher, Hank DeBruin, who hails from the Toronto, Canada area, and also another very famous Siberian musher, Karen Ramstead. We're hoping to have her on relatively soon. But a lot of folks know those dogs. And, you know, of course, Karen talks about pretty curly tails and that sort of thing. Can you a little bit to folks that are listening that may have a Siberian sitting there at their feet watching the football game tonight or whatever they're doing, and how these guys are different from your average Siberian pet?
Well, a lot of time and what's the word I want? Education and just studying pedigrees and knowing the dogs, not just the names, but what kind of dogs they were, has gone into a lot of those lines to come out with a dog that can perform the way it should. And there's a lot of dogs out there that, you know, that yes, they're beautiful Siberian Huskies, and they might do great in, you know, running down the trail and stuff. But to go day after day, you know, 40 to 50 miles a day, it takes the proper build and training and conditioning, and it's a dedication to go into those. And you mentioned Karen Ramstead, and a lot of my dogs have some of her lines in them. I've kind of got a menagerie of lines that I've mixed up with my to come up with my own stock, but they can perform, and you know, the true test is taking them out on the trail and putting them in harness to see what they can do, and it's a real eye-opener.
So without getting too technical, when you talk about build and physique and that sort of thing, how is it different than your average Siberian pet that you may pick up from, you know, ad in the newspaper or at the pet store or something like that? You know, your basic pet Siberian that a lot of folks have.
Well, most of it starts down in the skeleton. Their structure, it's described in the standard, in the AKC standard. You can go on to their website and look it up for any breed. But then comes in the interpretation of that standard. It talks about how their shoulders have to be and their bones and different angles. And then you go beyond that into their muscles and their tone and their coat. Some can have way too much coat, and they're going to get hot. And a lot of people can't imagine a dog getting hot at minus 20 or 30 degrees, but they can because they're working hard. And an easy way to check that is to just put a bunch of clothes on and go outside. But even that's not the true test, because people sweat differently than dogs, and so it's really hard to understand as far as heat-wise, but it's just like a true athlete just looking at, like, people running marathons. You know, you have to be physically fit and toned and all that.
Well, you know, a funny story is years ago I used to show some of my sled dogs, my Siberian guys, and I would always get the craziest looks from the class that I was in, you know, the other Siberian breeders. And even some of them would say, what the heck kind of a Siberian is that? You know, they would have the cute and cuddly little poofy little Siberians, but my guys didn't look like that. They looked a lot like yours, a lot sleeker, a lot leaner, a lot, like you said, a lot more like an athlete. Is that the norm in how they should look as an athlete versus the show dog?
Well, I think you can have a nice medium, and that's always my focus on, because when you see a Siberian Husky, you should think moderate, not just one extreme to the other. The whole thing should be moderate, moderate coat, moderate, you know, you don't want a big Siberian, you don't want a little Siberian, you don't want a heavy coat, you don't want a too short or light of a coat. You want a nice medium, moderate, dense coat that looks like, you know, a nice outline of the dog. But if they get too fluffy, they're just, you know, it's like putting on too many fur coats, I think.
Right, right. April Cox is our guest here tonight on Mushing Radio. April, do you have a website that you want to share, or should people just head over to Facebook?
Facebook's the best way to catch up with me right now. I have my profile under my name, of course, and then I have a page under Badass Musher. There's only one S in there.
Hey, that's okay. We can say anything we want here on this radio. So
well, yeah, but...
But it is Badass Mushing on or Badass Musher on
yes.
On your Facebook page, which is
yes.
Pretty much dedicated to racing and that sort of thing. You know, the dogs. Where's
yeah,
your personal page?
Yeah, that's the best
page
place to follow me.
Right. Where your personal page, of course, is your personal stuff. So you're a little bit more active on there. So let's talk a little bit about racing. I know you entered into a race or two last year of some distance, and that's kind of new for you, isn't it?
Yes, I've always done like the sprint, the longest being in 2010. I did some mid-distance, which was down here. It's about 14 miles. But last year I was able to enter. I did an eight-dog class, and we did 22.4 miles 2 days in a row and did really quite well with that. And then I got an opportunity to go up to the Eagle Cap Extreme dog race up in Joseph, Oregon, and we did a six-dog 31-mile pot race, and that was in one day. But I also got the opportunity to run at night, which was also new for me. So it was pretty good. I'm looking forward to doing the West Yellowstone race for 22 miles again this year, but kicking it up a notch, planning on doing some 100-mile races.
You know, I ran that West Yellowstone race years ago, about 2000, 2001, and I remember somebody might know this name if we mention it. Doug Swingley ran that race and won that race, and of course he went on to win many Iditarods after that. So that's a pretty good race. Very cold conditions down that part of the country, isn't it?
Oh yeah, it's nice and cold. The first year I went in 2009, it was when we pulled into town, it was minus 24 degrees, which was way eye-opener for my dogs who'd been California, Central Valley, California, and cold to them was like 30. But, yeah, you mentioned Doug Swingley. He was there last year racing with some people and helping them out. But I think he was in the 12-dog class. But, yeah, you get a lot of Iditarod mushers down there because it's an early race and they get you out on the snow early to test some of the dogs and get an idea of what they might be doing it out on a sled versus your training rig.
And you mentioned the Eagle Cap Extreme race. I know that they also have, I don't know if it's a 200 or a 300, and I believe that's an Iditarod qualifier, isn't it?
Yes, they have a 200-mile race also, and it is an Iditarod qualifier. And depending on how I do this year with the 100-miler, then maybe in 2014 I might be up for the 200-mile race. Well, who knows?
Right, right. And, you know, that's kind of special because there's not a lot of races left anymore down in the lower 48 that are considered Iditarod qualifiers. The one in particular is the John Bear Grease Marathon in Minnesota. It's been canceled many times over the last several years because of snow. How was the snow conditions there at the Eagle Cap race?
All considering the winter everyone was having, they had pretty good snow on the trails. And, you know, I believe it. Everything goes in cycles, and so you just have to cycle each year out, and depends on the snow conditions is for each winter as it cycles through. But, yeah, they had really nice trails. It was quite challenging, good challenge for your sled driving skills, which is something I needed, and I really did quite well, and I enjoyed it, and their trails are just wonderful, and the community just goes all out for that race. It's just a wonderful, wonderful experience at that race.
You know, I think that's a very important part of any of these races, whether it's a sprint race or something as big as the Yukon Quest or the Iditarod. That community support is huge. And, you know, I think mushers need to learn about that and be more part of it. It's not just getting on the sled and taking off at the chute. It's talking to the locals and telling those stories to those kids. I think that's the most important part of mushing to the community is hearing that from the mushers because they're supporting us. They're the ones that are they're putting us up the hotels and feeding us meals and all that sort of thing. Do you agree?
Oh, I totally agree because, I mean, it's a different world out there and we have to, you know, tread lightly these days to be welcome back and that, like you said, there's a lot less races than there used to be, whether they're Iditarod qualifiers or just sprint races. There's a lot less, and we just need to do everything we can to keep the sport alive and be welcome back the next year.
And I know you're a great ambassador for not only Siberian Huskies and dogs, but for mushing in general. How do you explain the sport to folks, you know, that may just have a passing interest? How do you get them involved? How do you get them excited about something like dog sledding? Because it's not, you know, it's not football. It's not baseball. It's not something you go sit in a stadium or in a field and watch. How do you get people excited about this?
Well, it's kind of depends on the person. Most people are just, you know, can relate to Iditarod, and a lot of them that don't relate to the mushing world, after you talk to them about it, and then they start thinking about it, and then next thing you know, they're like mentioning, oh, guess what I saw in the newspaper yesterday and stuff like that. And then because once they meet somebody who's involved in the sport, then they can tie into it a little better. And you just, you know, but a lot of people have heard of it, and actually, you know, whether they agree or disagree with it, but most people in general have actually heard of mushing. But then, you know, once they meet somebody who does it, they change their whole attitude depending on how you – and I just describe how, you know, how much the dogs love to do it and how much I love to do it. And it's kind of fun, especially going to – I got a chance to do a talk over at a school in Lakeview last March, and we talked to the whole school. There was like 30-something kids in the entire school. It was an elementary school, very small, but – We were well received, and the kids were just so excited to learn about it. And they followed Iditarod and their favorite mushers in the classroom, and it was kind of a really good experience. I really enjoyed talking to the kids about it, because hopefully one of them is going to continue on, take it up, and continue on later down the road.
Well, as they say, you catch the mushing bug or the mushing virus, and once you do, you're hooked for life, aren't you?
Oh, yes.
So April Cox is our guest tonight on Mushing Radio. You can listen to us anytime on mushingradio.com and follow us along on Facebook and Twitter by following Mushing Radio or Dogworks Radio on Facebook or Twitter. April, my next question is about the learning curve going from sprint mushing to mid-distance and hopefully for long distance for you. You mentioned that your first race last year, you were able to do some night runs and camps and that sort of thing. What was that learning curve like from, you know, hooking them up on the truck and running a few miles and come back and then hooking them and then going back out the next day? How, describe that for us. Tell us more about that experience.
Well, when the opportunity to run at night, I didn't do it the second day because it was just a one-day race, but training, I was where I live now, I'm able to just hook up right in the dog yard and train out into the Modoc forest, and it makes it a lot easier for getting the miles on, because you're not spending so much time and gas driving to get to your training site. But, you know, using the quad, you know, you got to get your confidence and your leaders up to, because for a night run, even with the headlamp, seeing just six dogs is tough. I can't imagine, how much harder it is for running 10, 12, 14, or even 16 dogs like they do on Iditarod, because you got to trust your leaders entirely out on the trail, because you're not going to be able to see what they can see, especially at night. And learning, you know, to trust your dogs is a huge step in the learning curve as far as distance mushing, because I lost my train of thought.
That's okay. And, you know, you mentioned the headlamp and being able to see all the way down that dog line, and you mentioned that six-dog team, I don't know, 15, 20 feet long from the leaders to where you're standing. But when you start adding dogs and adding distance, there is a big difference in, you know, in that distance between the musher and his lead dogs. And I remember Jason Barron, Iditarod veteran, told me one time that he puts very cheap headlamps around the collars of his leaders, so they have like little driving lights on the leaders, so you keep track of them a little better. Have you ever tried anything like that?
Well, my friend that I went racing to Eagle Cap with, Hugo Antonucci, he had some little blinking lights that we hooked on our leaders, and I think it was distracting the dogs more than not, maybe because they blinked. So we might try something a little different.
You know,
but that was the only time I've tried that.
You mentioned camping and how important not only camping but a checkpoint routine is from that step from sprint mushing to mid-distance and then into long distance. Have you got that figured out yet? Do you have a method yet? It's almost a science from the time you pull into a checkpoint to time you leave.
No, that's coming up as part of my training for this fall is to go out and do some overnight camps and learn how to use my cooker and come out with that routine. And it's not just cooking, melting the snow, you know, and whatever, and tending the dogs, but it's also, I also got to come down with a routine of putting all that stuff back in the sled and get that whole routine down. And that'll be part of my training for this fall.
Right. And, you know, a lot of people think when we say camping with the dogs that we're setting up a tent and, you know, laying back reading a book. It's not like that, is it? You're out there working pretty much all the time.
Yep, the dogs are resting and you're working, you're getting all their food ready, getting their water ready, checking their feet for any checking for any injuries and making sure everybody's taken care of, and then you're putting everything back, and you might take a few minutes to stick a little food down your throat, but most of the time is going to be spent taking care of the dogs and that. And no, there's no pitching tent. You're going to be sleep out on the race. You're sleeping in your sled or on the ground or whatever, usually, you know, just a little. I mean, Iditarod, they have at the checkpoints, they have some of the places where the mushers can actually go in and stuff. But the couple races that I'm going to be doing for 100 milers, you're just on your own outside in the cold.
And that's a great point, and we can't stress that enough about how important it is to get out there and do that over and over and over again, because so many variables come into place, and hopefully those variables come into place during training versus at a race, and you're in the middle of nowhere in unfamiliar conditions and that sort of thing. April, my next question is actually, it's a point. You mentioned how important it was to be able to run right from your yard, from the dog lot. And, you know, that was one of the primary reasons for us moving to Alaska, because we used to have to, you know, pack up our dogs and drive 2, 3, 4 hours to find decent snow in Colorado. And I remember when I was visiting you when you were living in Central California, we had to drive a heck of a distance with your teams just to go on a, you know, a 5 or a 6 mile run. Of course, it was a summer run, but it took a heck of a long time to get there. Is that a big motivator for you now at your new place to get up and go every day? Or, you know, you don't have to sit back and think, oh my goodness, it's going to take all day to do, you know, a short little run like it was in the past.
Well, I personally really didn't mind the drive. It was, you know, from where I lived, it was anywhere from where I took you, it was about 14 miles, but because of the road, we had a drive slow because of the curvy mountain road, so it took like just over an hour. And when I wanted to go up to the other place for get out on the sled and stuff, it was still a good hour driving, and it really didn't bother me that much because I knew I was going to spend a couple, you know, whatever time with the dogs and out and run. And that's because that's what I had to do. But, yes, it's a real big motivator to just be able to just go out and jump on the quad, pull in the dog yard, hook the dogs up and just go and come back and put everybody away. And it's not as taxing on me as a musher. It makes
right.
it a lot easier to.
Hey,
but
you
I'm
know,
still going to have to truck them out and hit a couple groomed trails. But there's some good snowmobile trail systems over in Weed, which is only a couple-hour drive, but it, you know, and it'll be worth it to get out on some groomed trails. But for basic training, just using the quad and stuff, it's really good to get the dogs out there.
And you're able to do it often like that. I mean, you can go out with more than one team at once. You can go out, you know, you can run in the morning and run at night. You don't have to, you know, plan your whole day about driving an hour or 2 hours to go to find a particular trail. My next question, April, we have about 5 minutes left, and I've wanted to ask you this for a long time because I know you're a big mushing fan. And on this show, we primarily have had Iditarod mushers on, so you're one of the first just regular mushers like me and other folks that listen to this show. My question to you is, how can we promote the sport the best way as fans of the sport? Obviously, the people that we follow, we follow them because we love the sport and we participate in it. But, you know, social media has changed mushing a little bit. Everybody's following and watching the spot trackers and that sort of thing. How do you think it can evolve to the next level compared to where it is right now? Because I know you're very active during Iditarod time.
Oh, the best thing I can do is just try to put a positive light on anybody that, you know, questions what we're doing and why and how we do it, just to try and take that opportunity, you know, and just educate them that, you know, we're not making the dogs do this, and they enjoy doing it, and just to, you know, pay attention to people, and if they're, you know, talking negative about it, just try and, you know, educate them, because obviously if they're talking negative about it, they don't know much about it.
Right.
Is how I feel.
What would you like to see in terms of how mushing is covered from a fan perspective? You know, Facebook is doing a great job. There's all kinds of posts. You know, I know Iditarod has a very cool Facebook page that they do, as well as Yukon Quest. And, you know, they have the Iditarod Insider and that sort of thing. What would you like to see as a fan in the way that the Iditarod or, you know, the Yukon Quest or other mushing events are covered from what they're doing right now?
Oh, well, the only thing I could think of is maybe try to get a little more on television, because a lot of people, you know, there's still quite a few people, amazingly, that don't get on Facebook.
Exactly.
And so maybe, you know, just try and maybe put little blurbs on TV, and is all I could figure. I don't know.
Is there much talk about the Iditarod and things down there, especially in California? I remember living in Colorado, there was about the Colorado mushers, and of course, when I was living in Minnesota as well. But what about in California? Is it ever in the newspaper? Is it ever on the news compared to some non-mushing areas like where you're at?
Well, actually, yeah, it has made it into newspapers down in Fresno a couple time or two, because when I was working down there, the president of the company worked there, too, and he came in a couple days ago. Guess what was in the newspaper? Something about Iditarod. And he was all excited because he could relate to it because I worked there. But so it's surprising. There is a lot of schools down in California that do follow the race, and a lot of adults that, you know, if they hear something about it, they go, oh, okay, cool. So, yeah, it's surprising how much there is out there, but there could probably be a little bit more.
Of course. There can always be more.
Always be more.
I think the more that they do, the better it is for the sport. April, we have a couple of I have a little bit of a cold here for my listeners that aren't used to the voice that I have this evening. You have a couple of minutes left. Anything else you want to mention? Anybody you want to thank? Any dogs you want to mention in particular? Anything like that?
Well, I will take this moment to thank my son last year for all his help that he gave me in training. But I also, a huge thank you to my friends, Hugo and Terry Antonucci, because I live at their place, and if it wasn't for them, I don't know where I'd be living right now. And he gave me the opportunity to move up and go train my dogs and mush dogs. And so he's going to help me learn how to do the overnight camping and stuff. And so I owe a huge thank you to them.
You know, very cool. April, I'm so glad that you're able to join us today. I know it's in only a 30-minute program. We didn't get to get into everything we wanted to talk about, but, you know, you're an awesome person. You're a great ambassador for the sport, and I'm so happy to have met you. And you and I have had a pretty good friendship over, I don't know, 4 years, 5 years now, and I'm glad that you're out there doing your thing.
Well, thank you, Robert. I think you're pretty awesome, too, and I'm glad to have met you.
Well, thank you again. Anytime you come up to Alaska, you're always welcome to hit up some of our trails, because we got some awesome trails right in our backyard as well.
Well, maybe someday. I haven't yet got up there, but I plan to.
Very good. Very good. Well, April, thank you very much. April Cox was our guest tonight. You can find out more about her on her Facebook page. Check out Bad As AS Musher on Facebook, and she'll be sure to give you as much up-to-date information as she can. April, it was my pleasure. We'll talk again soon, okay?
Thanks for having me. Bye-bye.
All right. And this is Robert Forto on behalf of our guest tonight. We'll see you guys next time. Goodbye.